When the path dog-legged and changed direction, the mules could not make the turn in one attempt. They were forced to back and fill, edging their way round the narrow trail, sweating with terror and their eyes rolling until the whites flashed. The drivers urged them on with wild cries and busy whips. At places the pathway entered the body of the mountain, passing behind butts and needles of rock that time and erosion had prized away from the cliff face. These rocky gateways were so narrow that the mules had to be unloaded and the packs carried through by the drivers, and then the mules were reloaded on the far side. "Look!" Royan cried in astonishment and pointed out into the void. A black vulture rose up out of the depths on widespread pinions and floated past them almost within arm's length, turning its gruesome naked head of pink lappeted skin to stare at them with inscrutable black eyes before sailing away. "He's using the thermals of heated air from the valley for lift," Nicholas explained to her. He pointed out along the cliff to an overhanging buttress on the same level as themselves. "There's one of their nests." It was a shaggy mound of sticks piled on an inaccessible ledge. The excrement of the birds that had inhabited it over the ages had painted the cliff face below with streaks of brilliant white, and even at this distance they could catch whiffs of rotting offal and decaying flesh. All that day they clung to the precipitous track as they eased their way down that terrible wall. It was late afternoon, and they were only halfway down when the trail turned back on itself once more, and they heard the rumble of the falls ahead. The sound grew louder and became a thunderous roar as they moved around the corner of another buttress and came in full sight of the falls. The wind created by the torrent tugged at them and forced them to clutch for handholds. The spray blew around them and wetted their upturned faces, but the Ethiopian guide led them straight on until it seemed that they must be washed away into the valley still hundreds of feet below. Then, miraculously, the waters parted, and they stepped behind the great translucent curtain into a deep recess of moss-covered and gleaming wet rock carved from the cliff by the force of water over the eons. The only light in this gloomy place was filtered through the waterfall, green and mysterious, like some undersea cavern. "This is where we sleep tonight," Boris announced, obviously enjoying their astonishment. He pointed to bundles of firewood piled at the rear of the cave and the smoke-blackened wall above the stone hearth. "The muleteers, carrying food and supplies down to the priests in the monastery, have used this place for centuries." As they moved deeper into the cavern, the sound of falling water became muted to a dull background rumble, and the rock underfoot was dry. Once the servants had lit the fire, it became a warm and comfortable, not to say romantic, lodging. With an old soldier's eye for the most comfortable spot, Nicholas laid out his sleeping bag in a corner at the back of the cave, and quite naturally Royan unrolled hers beside his. They were both tired out by the unusual exertion of climbing down the cliff wall, and after supper they stretched out in their sleeping bags in companionable silence and watched the firelight playing on the roof of the cave. "Just think," Royan whispered, "tomorrow we will be retracing the footsteps of old Taita himself." "To say nothing of the Virgin Mary," Nicholas smiled. "You are a horrid old cynic," she sighed, "and what is more, you probably snore." "You're about to find out the hard way," he told her. But she was asleep before him. Her breathing was gentle and even, and he could just hear it above the sound of the water. It was a long time since he had had a lovely woman lying at his side. When he was sure she was deeply under, he reached across and touched her cheek gently. "Pleasant dreams, little one," he whispered tenderly. "You have had a busy day." That was the way he had often bid his younger daughter sleep. The muleteers were stirring long before the dawn, and the whole party was on the pathway again as soon as the light was strong enough to reveal their footing. When the early sun struck the upper falls of the cliff face, they were still high enough above the valley floor to have an aerial view of the terrain. Nicholas drew Royan aside, and they let the rest of the caravan go on down ahead of them. He found a place to sit and unrolled the satellite photograph between them. Picking out the major peaks and features of the scene, they orientated themselves and began to make some order out of the cataclysmic landscape that rioted below them. "We can't see the Abai River from here," Nicholas pointed out. "It's still deep in the sub-gorge. We'll probably only get our first glimpse of it from almost directly above." "If we have identified our present position accurately, then the river will make two oxbow bends around the bluff. Over there." "Yes, and the confluence of the Dandira River with the Abai is over there, below those cliffs." He used his thumb knuckle as a rough scale measure. "About 15 miles from here." "It looks as though the Dandira has changed its course many times over the centuries. I can see at least two gullies that look like ancient riverbeds," she pointed down. "There, and there. They're all choked with jungle now." She looked crestfallen. "Oh, Nicholas, it's such a huge and confused area. How are we ever going to find the single entrance to a tomb hidden in all that?"
"Tomb? What tomb is this?" Boris demanded with interest. He had come back up the trail to find them. They had not heard his approach, and now he stood over them. "What tomb are you talking about?"
"Why, the tomb of St. Frumentius, of course," Nicholas told him smoothly, showing no concern at having been overheard. "Isn't the monastery dedicated to the saint?" Ryan asked as smoothly, as she rolled up the photograph.
"Da!"
he nodded, looking disappointed, as though he expected something of more interest.
"Yes, St. Frumentius. But they will not let you visit the tomb. They will not let you into the inner part of the monastery. Only the priests are allowed in there."
He removed his cap and scratched the short, stiff bristles that covered his scalp. They rasped like wire under his fingernails.
"This week is the ceremony of Timkat, the blessing of the Tabot. There will be a great deal of excitement down there. You will find it very interesting, but you will not be able to enter the Holy of Holies, nor will you be able to see the actual tomb. I have never met any white man who has seen it."
He squinted up at the sun.
"We must get on. It looks close, but it will take us 2 more days to reach the Abai. It is bad ground down there. A long march, even for a famous Dikdik hunter."
He laughed delightedly at his own joke, and turned away down the path. As they approached the bottom of the cliff, the gradient of the trail smoothed out, and the steps became shallower and further apart. The going became easier, and their progress swifter, but the air had changed in quality and taste. It was no longer cool, bracing mountain air, but the languid, enervating air of the equator, with the smell and taste of the encroaching jungle.
"Hot," said Ryan, shrugging out of the woolen shawl.
10 degrees hotter, at least," Nicholas agreed. He pulled his old army jersey over his head, leaving his hair in curly disarray. "And we can expect it to get hotter before we reach the Abbey. We still have to descend another 3,000 feet. Now the path followed the Dandira River for a while. Sometimes they were several hundred feet above it, and shortly afterwards they splashed waist-deep through a ford, hanging on to the panniers of the mules to keep themselves from being swept away on the flood. Then the gorge of the Dandira River was too deep and steep to follow any longer, as sheer cliffs dropped into dark pools, so they left the river and followed the track that squirmed like a dying snake amongst eroded hills and tall red stone bluffs. A mile or two further downstream they rejoined the river, in a different mood as it rippled through dense forest. The dangling lianas swept the surface, and tree moss brushed their heads as they passed, straggling and unkempt as the beard of the old priest at Debra Mariam. Vervet monkeys chattered at them from the treetops and ducked their heads in wide-eyed outrage at the human intrusion into these secret places. Once a large animal crashed away through the undergrowth, and Nicholas glanced across at Boris. The Russian shook his head, laughing.
"No, English, not Dikdik, only kudu." On the hillside above them, the kudu paused to look back. He was a large bull, with full twists to his wide corkscrew horns, a magnificent beast, with a maned dewlap and pricked ears shaped like trumpets. He stared at them with huge, startled eyes. Boris whistled softly, and his attitude changed abruptly.
"Those horns are over 50 inches. They would get a place right at the top of Roland Ward."
He was referring to the register of big game, which was the Bible of the trophy hunter.
"Don't you want to take him, English?"
He ran to the nearest mule and pulled the Rigby rifle from its slipcase, then ran back and offered it to Nicholas.
"Oh, let him go," Nicholas shook his head. "Only Dick Dick for me."
With a flirt of his white powder puff tail, the bull was gone over the ridge. Boris shook his head disgustedly and spat into the river.
"Why did he try to insist that you kill it?"
Royan demanded as they went on.
"Oh, a photograph of a record pair of horns like that would look good on his advertising brochure. Suck in more clients."
All day they followed the winding trail, and in the late afternoon they camped in a clearing above the river where it was evident that other caravans had camped many times before them. It seemed obvious that this road was divided into time-honoured stages. Every traveller took 3 full days from the top of the falls to reach the monastery, and they all camped the same sites.
"Sorry, no shower here," Boris told his clients. "If you want to wash, there is a safe pool around the first bend upstream."
Ryan looked appealingly at Nicholas.
"I'm so hot and sweaty. Please won't you stand guard for me where you can hear me call if I need you?"
So he lay on the mossy bank just below the bend, out of sight, but close enough to hear her splash and squeal at the cold embrace of the water. Once, when he turned his head, he realized that the current must have drifted her downstream, for through the trees he caught a flash of a naked back and the curve of a buttock, creamy and glistening wet with water. He looked away again guiltily, but he was startled by the intensity of his physical arousal, brought on by that brief glimpse of lambent skin dappled with the late sunlight through the trees. When she came downstream along the bank, singing softly, toweling her wet hair, she called to him.
"Your turn. Do you want me to stand guard for you?"
"I'm a big boy now."
He shook his head, but as she passed him he noticed the saucy glint in her eye, and he wondered suddenly if she had been fully aware of just how far downstream she had swum, and how much he had seen. He was titillated by the thought. He went upstream to the pool alone, and as he stripped he looked down at himself and felt guilty when he saw how she had moved him. Since Rosalind, no other woman had had this effect on him.
"A nice cold plunge won't do you any harm, my lad."
He threw his jeans over a bush and dived into the pool. As they sat at the campfire after the evening meal, Nicholas looked up suddenly and cocked his head.
"Am I hearing things?" he wondered.
"No," Tessé laughed. "That is singing you hear. The priests from the monastery are coming to welcome us." They saw the torches then, winding up the hillside in procession, flickering through the trees as they approached the camp. The muleteers and the servants crowded forward, singing and clapping rhythmically to greet the deputation from the monastery. The deep male voices soared and then dropped away, almost to a whisper, then rose again in descant, haunting and beautiful. The sound of Africa in the night. It drove icy thrills down Nicholas's spine, so that he shivered involuntarily.